Kia ora tātou, one and all. Yeah, it's my pleasure once again. Great turnout, thank you very much. As I said last time, we've concentrated on anniversaries and commemorations this year. And so we've gone through the early land wars period right through to the present day and had a look at what significant anniversaries have occurred across all of our services. So we don't just stick to the brown jobs, we do the blue jobs and we do the white jobs and all the rest of it. So the next couple of months, we're actually giving the Air Force an opportunity. So it's our great pleasure today to welcome Wing Commander Peter Hurley, although he's in civvies today. Active Reserve, or still serving. Yeah, he just doesn't want to give up. Peter's also the President of the Palmerston North RSA, so he's got a few busy hats to wear. But Peter's going to talk to us about the 70th anniversary of Number 14 Squadron and the service that they had in Malaya in particular, but across a whole different type of aircraft. Can you please welcome Peter Hurley?
Thank you. As Joe says, this is a talk about the 14th Squadron in the Malayan Emergency, and that's really an iconic photograph of the 14th Squadron Venoms on Tenga Airfield starting up, and they used Kaufman cartridges to start the turbojets, and these were like the big shotgun cartridges, and they sort of went off, and they went off with a pretty dramatic sort of plume of smoke, and so I thought that was a good one to start. There's also the badge of 14 Squadron, and next to it is Communist China flag that we'll be talking about. So, when I looked at this, I thought, oh yeah, we can try and put something together, and then the more I looked at it, the more I thought, this is actually a huge topic, and 14 Squadron is only just a small cog within a huge area, and I can't really start on talking about 14 Squadron without some sort of background. And the more I worked on the background, I thought, this is bigger than 14 Squadron itself. So, basically, we're going to talk a wee bit about the historical background, then the background to the Malayan Emergency as such, the initial response to that, and New Zealand's contribution, which was pretty significant, and then the formation and role of 14 Squadron, the types of aircraft that were flown with 14 Squadron mainly, some key operations and missions, and then what did they achieve, what were the challenges, and then we'll conclude. So, in the beginning, Malaya. The formation of Malaya itself is so complex. Initially, there were about two human remains were found that were about 2 million years old in the area. And then there were a number of civilizations that that took place. Buddhism and Hinduism were the main religions at the time, and China had a big influence. There's a within the area there's that statue of Xin He, which was he was a Chinese prominent citizen in Malaya at the time. Subsequent to that, then the Portuguese occupied Malacca, which was an important area because it had a port and was good for trading, and they occupied it in 1511. And then subsequently, the Dutch, in association with some of the Sultanates, took Malacca away from the Portuguese in 1641. And then the Dutch had it for quite a long time until the Napoleonic Wars, when Holland was, or the Dutch were worried about the French taking over, and so they passed it over to Britain to look after until the Napoleonic Wars were over. But then subsequent to that, there were a number of various treaties signed, and it ended up with the Dutch handing over the Malacca to the British, and the Dutch took over part of the East Indies, Indonesia. And the British then started putting together some settlements and so on, and they came up with, first of all, the Strait Settlement. Here's a flag of the Strait Settlement that took place at the time. And then after that, it sort of morphed into the Federated Malay and the Unfederated Malay States. And then subsequent to that, they started having certain amounts of independence within some of the states, which I'll show you a little bit later. Then suddenly World War II broke out, and the area was taken over by the Japanese. And the Japanese did a pretty good job in occupying Malaya. In just 3 months, they hit it right down and ended up capturing Singapore. And that was under Lieutenant General Yamashita. New Zealand was now worried about this, and they contributed 488 Squadron to Singapore, which was equipped with Brewster Buffaloes. They were no match for the Japanese. Singapore surrendered in February, and Lieutenant General Percival was the person who signed that surrender document, and was present at the end of the war when the Japanese surrendered. The Japanese had a cruel program through Malaya, and there were a huge number of atrocities that they perpetrated. I've just put that in to sort of show you some of the complexity of what happened. So the Strait Settlement took those four red areas. Then there was the Federated Malay States, and then the blue were the Unfederated Malay States, which all of it enjoyed the protection of Britain, but the others, the Federated and the red, were actually really more of British subjects, and the Unfederated had a certain amount of autonomy. Then in 1948, they had Federation of Malaya with that flag. And part of the problem that then arose was that the population consisted of Malays, Chinese, and Indians, and Britain was planning on giving the Chinese citizenship. But the Malays didn't want that, and so the Chinese were kept away from that, or not allowed to have citizenship, many of them. So that resulted in bitterness and the formation of the Chinese resistance. Then on the 16th of June 1948, was the Sengai Siput episode, and three British managers of rubber plantations were murdered, and that then caused Britain to the next day to organise to declare a state of emergency, and they made it an emergency, not a war, even though it lasted 12 years. The reason for that was insurance. So because it was an emergency, the plantation owners and the miners could claim insurance if the terrorists disrupted some of their areas. But if it was a war, then they couldn't get the insurance. So that's That was the reason that it's been called an emergency. Then independence came in 1947, followed by the actual federation in 63, and Singapore left in 65. This is the gentleman who is really responsible for it all, Chin Peng, a Chinese gentleman. He was born on the 21st of October, 24, and he died nearly 90 years of age in China. He was very much a supporter of Chinese ethnicity, and when he was a student, he formed the Chinese Anti-Enemy Backing Up Society. That's a bit of a mouthful. Basically, what they did was they were contributing support, monetary mainly, to China, who at that stage were fighting the Japanese pre-World War II. Then Japan invaded, and so he joined the Communist Party and became formed a guerrilla Malayan anti-Japanese People's Army. He was assisted by the British with Force 4136 with regard to training and supplying of weapons. There's their emblem. And Force 136 said, "We will train you, we will supply you with weapons, and at the end of the hostilities, we want our weapons back." Yeah, right. He did such a good job that he was actually awarded the OBE. And then when he discovered that Britain was not going to grant the Chinese citizenship, he formed the Malayan Racial Liberation Army, because at that stage he was saying, we don't want to be under now British rule. Just to give you some demographics, and sorry, when I copied this, it really changed the syntax a little bit, but anyway, in 1952 there were over 5 million people in Malaya, 2.5 million who were Malays, 2 million, significant number, were Chinese, and then there were 386 of Indian or Pakistani stock. The population was widely dispersed, and there also were a number of Chinese who, as I say, had no citizenship, and they became the squatters because they'd moved north during the Japanese invasion to escape the Japanese. In addition to that, there were about 100,000 Aborigines, and these were looked down on by the Malayan people. So Britain responded initially with a bit of brute force, and that didn't go down very well. Britain responded initially with brute force, and the Scots Guards were accused of, well, not accused, the Scots Guards committed the atrocity of murdering about 30 or so Malayan men, unarmed people, and that was the Baling Kali massacre that I've got up there. That has been possibly Britain's equivalent to the My Lai massacre that took place in Vietnam, although My Lai was much bigger. So there was detention without trial, and then they brought in General Briggs, who decided to take out the Chinese people and put them into camps, protected areas, which was initially not really, which was initially sort of upset the Chinese, but it did work quite well. Then the High Commissioner in Malaya, Henry Gurney, was actually ambushed, and then Churchill said, "Right, we're going to get this gentleman to come and take over both as High Commissioner and as Director of Operations," and that's that was General Templer. And he looked at this and said, no, we can't just do this draconian sort of response. What we have to do is look at the hearts and minds and do what we can to bring the people onto our side. I said it was quite a big response, so there's a list of the Commonwealth forces that were involved. UK, Federation of Malaya, Singapore, Malacca and Penang until the Federation, Kenya, Rhodesia, Nyasaland, Fiji, Australia and New Zealand. So it was a significant contribution. New Zealand's response was also significant considering the size. In 1949, Douglas C-47 Dakotas of 41 Squadron were attached to the Far East Air Force, and they did a lot of work with supplies and drops. There were 133 soldiers of New Zealand SAS, which was formed. The Royal New Zealand Navy supplied a number of ships from time to time. Then the SAS were brought back, and one Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment took over. Then 14 Squadron came on board and subsequently handed over to 17 Squadron. So, 14 Squadron. Initially formed on April 1942 in response to the Japanese threat. They, at that stage, flew Harvards and then P-40 Kitty Hawks and subsequently Corsairs. They were about to be fitted with P-51 Mustangs, but then the war ended, and they had a final parade in Iwakuni, Japan, in March 1946, and then they were re-equipped with de Havilland Mosquitoes, and then subsequently with Vampires. So there we've got the Harvards, the Kitty Hawks, Corsairs, and the Mosquito. There's a picture of the final parade in Japan, and then they returned, and the RAF gave them a Gloucester Meteor. So New Zealand now joined the jet age, and they started to learn to fly jet aircraft. They then bought some Vampires from the from Britain, and also leased several from the RNZ, from the RAF. They were deployed to Nicosia to help with the stability of the Middle East area. And there we've got the gate guard out at Ahakia, which is the pride of place as you come into Ahakia. From Cyprus, they went to the Tenga Air Force Base in Singapore in 1954. 40 Squadron helped move them in the handy-paid Hastings, and they joined the Commonwealth Strategic Reserve as with three other squadrons, one Royal Australian Air Force, 60 RAF, and the Malayan Air Force Squadron as well. Their mission was mainly to, initially, to protect Singapore, but then they also were given the day fighter attack role and ground support. There were two types of operations, the Fire Dog and the Smash Hits. Fire Dog was a pre-planned operation, and that would then fly over to wherever they had to go, release their bombs, fire their rockets, etc. Smash Hits were a more immediate response to a threat. Malaya, thick jungle, so really not very good navigation at the time, but it made things quite difficult, and I'll talk a little bit more about Fire Dog further down. They were also told that they could assist in protection of airfields because they were worried too about China at that stage. So they moved to Malaya with the first lot of personnel and aircraft that moved were under Flight Lieutenant Stu McIntyre, and he in fact conducted the very first 14 Squadron offensive in Johor on the 1st of May 1955. There's a picture of the Venom, and with Barry Flavel, who was a young pilot there at the time, and these were now leased from the RAF, and when they were on an exercise with CETO, so the US was not involved in the Malayan emergency, but with CETO they were, they came, some of the USAF ground crew came to have a look. The guy thumped on it and said, "Geez, fella, it's made out of wood. We're going back to the Wright brothers." The person who reported this said, "Nevertheless, we knocked the pants off them when it came to the serviceability of the aircraft." The aircraft had a limit of 750 aircraft hours, and if you got it up to above Mach 0.86, it went into a spin, which is quite often uncontrollable. So there's a little bit of a comparison between the Vampire and the Venoms. Stu McIntyre said the Venom was really a vampire with hairy chests. So initially, the Vampire was powered by the Goblin aircraft engine, the Venom with the Ghosts. The wings on the Vampire were a fairly thick section, the wings on the Venom were thinner with a leading sweep. There was no fuel tanks on the Vampires, but there were on the Venoms. As I said, the fuselage was aluminium and wood. The Vampires could do about 500 miles per hour, and the Venoms with the new air, engine, the Ghost engine, could go to about 640. A little bit about the airfield at Tengah. Singapore at that stage was not like Singapore now. At that stage, it was just after the war. It was hot, steamy. Drains were not working well. There was a heat and smell. Tom Lambert was there at the time. He can tell you all about it later on. As I say, Stu McIntyre took the first flight across, and then when the squadron came over in full, it was under squadron leader Bright. There he is there resting. And that's Stu in the middle. There's some pictures of the armourers that were working on the aircraft. Then, subsequent to Bright being the CO, Tucker took over, and then he was taken over by Wallingford, and there he is down there. But when Wallingford took over, that was now at the time of the confrontation, which is another story. There were some families that were allowed to come and join them. I'll talk about that in a moment. The barracks were somewhat rudimentary. The food was not appreciated. In fact, they came up with a game that they would take the dehydrated mashed potato and try and throw it up on the slowly rotating fans above them to see how they would stick on the fans. When the orderly officer came, and because the cooks were not happy with this, one of them picked up a can of the dehydrated mash and said, "Look at this, 1944 dehydrated mash." The orderly officer said, "Yeah, okay, I see your point." The fire dog process, that pre-planned process, was quite long, and it wasn't supposed to be, but it ended up because a message would come from the troops in the area, be relayed back to the controlling part in Singapore, that would go to Tengah. Meantime, the poor pilots were sitting in the aircraft waiting in the hot, sweltering sun, and it was a very warm place to be in that aircraft. That brought about something that we learned called Fighter Index of Thermal Stress, which tried to work out how long a pilot could sit in that cockpit with his flying gear on, and how long before he got heat exhaustion or heat stroke. The unattached airman, as I said, had it worse than those with families. I'm not going to explain that, but there's a little diagram showing how we used the fighter index of thermal stress to try and figure out when it was too dangerous to sit in the aircraft. Don Stewart, you'll know about that. Where are you? there are some of the pilots sort of resting and obviously not wearing their flying gear at the moment in the heat. picture of Tenga Airfield, a high-level photograph there, and then near the end of it, 14 Squadron with their vampires around and a parade with the members forming the number 14. So I thought that was quite a nice picture to include there. As I said, the unaccompanied airmen were living in these three-story barracks. They had narrow beds with horsehair mattresses. They were 2 feet apart from the other person next to them. They had a small locker and a cabinet. There was not much for them to do, so they ended up sort of going to places like Change Alley and the Tiger Barn Gardens, which resulted, of course, in some certain unsavory medical conditions. And they tried to get the medical officer to do their talk to the people. Well, it wasn't just the squadron, it was the whole of armies and navies and air forces all around. But anyway, the medical officer had to do a talk to the personnel to talk about the dangers of venereal disease. I remember when I was at SMO at Lipton, I was asked to give one of these talks, and I thought, oh boy. And I came and I stood and I looked at all these people staring at me with bored expressions like now, and I thought, how am I going to get their attention? So I said, in 1492 it said that Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue and thus began the syphilization of the whole world. That's the response I got, and they never asked me again. Families at Singapore, not only Air Force, Navy and Army were also allowed to come. However, that was only if you had a long posting. Tom only had a 6-month posting, and he was already married and he was unaccompanied. So do chat to Tom afterwards about that. He wasn't happy, were you? Eventually there were 42 families living in the accommodation or the RAF houses. The newspaper reported they were having fun. Nylons were only 3 and 6 a pair, and you could spend £100 to buy a 1949 Hudson. However, it was not all rose gardens. There was the heat, the fans swinging over, snakes, various insects disrupting sleep and so on. So wasn't quite as good as the reporters advised. I found this from a Wings publication some time ago by the NCO in charge of the flight line, John Ledge. He put a few photographs together, so there's some pictures of 14 Squadron pilots. And then he's got this picture of the mascot. Now, the mascot is not actually the monkey. I'm not sure how the monkey fit it in. The mascot really is the kiwi on the tail. And then he also put this picture in, and this was his highlight. As I say, he was in charge of the flight line. What he wanted to do was to try and get all the 18 Venoms together. And because of this, problems with the aircraft and so on, they never could, until on April Fool's Day in 1957 he got his option, got his chance, and there we have 18 Venoms all in line. 16 of the actual Venoms and two of the two-seater trainers. Just to talk about that mascot, when the original Venoms and Vampires were around, they had that chicken sort of picture on the tail, and then subsequently the kiwi appeared. Now, Fire Dog. This would be a section of 4 Venoms armed with 2,000-pound bombs or a number of rocket projectiles. They would get the message now to go and make a strike. An Oster, that little aircraft over there, would be hovering over the area where the strike was to take place, would drop a flare or smoke to allow them to see it and come in and know where to strike. Wasn't really a procession, but anyway, they very often couldn't find the aircraft, or they couldn't find the smoke, or they went to the wrong smoke. Couple of operations. Operation Saturation in December 55, when 752,000 bombs were dropped. The first fire dog of 1956 was Squadron Leader Bright, and Flying Officer Perry, who was the only Maori flying member at the time, he flew his Venom out to try and drop the bombs. He had two 1,000-pound bombs, and there was a hang-up. They wouldn't drop. And he thought, I've got these two armed bombs under my wings. He flew out to Castle Rock, which was the range practice, and he turned his aircraft upside down. He did whatever he could to try and shake off these bombs. He eventually got rid of one, but the other one was still on the wing. And he decided, right, I better land, come back, and he landed at Hialeah. And Stu McIntyre, with the armourers, rushed out to try and help and see, make sure the bomb was safe. And Stu says, while they were working, I looked around and I saw a little Malayan policeman holding a fire extinguisher. And I thought, what's that going to do against a 5,000-pound bomb? And that's the type of extinguisher. Operation Canterbury was a huge operation with a number of Lincolns and Venoms from both the RAF, the RNZAF, and then there were some Canberras. What happened was the RAF Lincolns flew in, missed the target, had to come back, and then fly in again. Meantime, these Venoms were behind, starting to use up fuel, and the RAF went in, and followed then by the RNZAF, and they said there was 45 seconds between each bombing run, because they were really worried about the fuel and getting back in time. In 1958, there was an increased activity in the area because independence had occurred in 57, and the Prime Minister said he wanted to try and get the emergency finished by the anniversary the following year. Well, that didn't quite happen, but that was the reason for the increased activity. The best or the most successful operation was Kingly Pyle. And that took place in the centre part of Johor, and seven Lincolns, four Canberras, and seven Venoms from the RNZAF took place in the strike. This was a CT, communist terrorist leader, who was led the 7th Independent Platoon. They got intelligence that where this person was, where the leader was. They flew a strike, and they actually did kill the leader, Go Ping Tuan, and the Fijians who were in the area came and they saw the wreck camp and brought back the bodies. So it was probably the only operation where they really were able to quantify the success of the operation. I found this, that number 2 squadron, which used to be a territorial squadron and then also became then a regular force squadron with the A4s, they did a little bit of time at Tenga, and there we've got squadron leader McCabe, CO of 2 squadron, with squadron leader Tucker, and of course the mascot on the tail of the Venom. Also found this, which is a logbook from Air Marshal David Crooks, who was there at the time. So there's his first one, sort of indicating his progress. Then we have his familiarization with vampires, and then familiarization with venoms, and then subsequently some of the operational ones are highlighted. That one in which he says, oops, two 1,000-pound bombs dropped, took an hour. It doesn't get, there's no more detail, so you've got to sort of wonder what was that about, what was the story behind that. Okay, coming to the end, yes. Then those venoms have now overtaken or reached their 750 hours because that was the flying time of the frame, and so they started now becoming hard to service, so much so that 14 Squadron used to go to 60 RAF to ask if they could borrow aircraft, and RAF loved this and had signs like aircraft for hire. So in May 1958 they were handed back. They dropped 500,000 pounds of bombs and 1,523 rockets. On the 15th of May they had a parade and a flypast. And then they were getting ready to leave because 75 Squadron was now coming in, and they had a new aircraft, the English Electric Canberra, which you have over here. At the end of the parade, CEO of 14 Squadron was presented with a kris, a ceremonial kris. This is not a ceremonial one, but that's what a kris looks like. It's a very, it's a Malaysian type of dagger, quite ornate sheath. And it's got that sort of really wavy type of blade. Now, some interesting aspects, just to finish off. Rugby, of course, was important. The squadron's captain was LAC Chuchu Makatu, and Stu McIntyre had a wing three-quarter who was really very good, but he was also he was also a little bit of a miscreant. And there were places that were out of bounds. This guy would always be found out of bounds. On Monday he'd be marched in under orders, and they'd put him in the slammer. On Wednesday, Stu McIntyre would go to the prison, bring him out for the practice, take him back to the slammer, say, goodbye, see you Saturday. They also had a game against the Fijians at Kuala Pila. That was right out in the jungle. They had to equip themselves with Sten guns and revolvers. And when they got there, the captain was a big Fijian RSM, who was also the boxing champion. And he said, before we start, we drink beer. And there were crates of beer on the field. And they said, no, no, we're here to play rugby. No, it's a friendly game. So they drank beer. All right, started the game, and he then said, every time there's a score, we drink beer. So the Kiwi's got a knock-on, they got a penalty, back to the beer. Hugh McIntyre says, I have no idea what the final score was. The first for the squadron was an ejection. In April 1957, that venom, not that one, but a venom had a flame out over the straits. Flight Lieutenant Mike Palmer was the pilot at the time. He was coming down. He thought, yeah, I'm going to have to eject. And he pulled on the ejection handle, and nothing happened. And he was now at 1,000 feet dropping, and he thought, wait a minute, I think I saw something. You've really got to pull hard. So he pulled hard, and bang, he went off. He was now at 800 feet. He was spiraling in the seat out of control before the parachute deployed properly. And he just landed in time in the harbour and was picked up by a police launch. The police launch had to do some really fast sailing to get out of the way of the falling vampire. Three others there. Ian Ferguson had a crash in his aircraft when he took off and landed in rubber trees. And there's a cutting of the destroyed aircraft, a newspaper cutting of it.
Stu McIntyre said he got there and he was saw a number of people all gathered around watching the sea cross sort of smouldering away and burning. The medical officer at the time thought he'd go and have a look. He didn't know too much about ejection seats, and the ejection seat suddenly went off and he nearly got decapitated. Then another vampire with flying officer Rudd had an engine failure, ditched in 5 feet of water. And then flying officer Hubbard, his aircraft went into a spin, as I've said, at 0.86 Mach, they tended to be uncontrollable, and he ejected. The good news is that in spite of that, there were no fatalities. Last little couple of pictures. In 2010, there was a reunion for held, and here's a picture of Stu McIntyre looking at the cockpit of a Strike Master. This is the appreciation of what happened afterwards by the UK Defence Force. I'll put that in just to show how the numbers of the communists, terrorists, increased in the first part and then started really decreasing by the end when the Hearts and Minds was working. So there we've got 3,900, 7,000, and then starts going down. 2,000, 1,000, 704, and by the end in 1960 there were only 564. And most of them had all headed north and were now in Thailand. Have to mention this part. Tu Chi Tu, also known as CDC2, was actually the Malayan head of the PSYOPs. And he did a very good job. And in fact, he was honored by the Malaysians afterwards. So they would fly and drop leaflets like this, which people would pick up and realize, gosh, I can get $3,000 if I tell the authorities where this particular communist terrorist is. They also had ration cards, so that idea was to try and deny food to the communist terrorists, because they would come and sneak into the Chinese areas and get them to hand them rice and food and so on. And then I love that one. Please, can we have our Bren gun back? Remember, we lent you a Bren gun, you've hidden it, and now we'd like it back, please. Okay, subsequently, 14 Squadron then leased the Canberras, B-12s from the RAF. They went back into the area, but now this time it was for the Indonesian confrontation. And that's another story. But there was a plan of the Plan Althorp, and that was actually to sneak in with these Canberras at very low level and actually attack airfields in Indonesia. Then they took over, they were equipped with Strike Masters over there. Subsequently, the Strike Masters saw the end of their life, and the Mackies came in, and they were pretty good aircraft as well. And then suddenly in 2001, a Labour Prime Minister said, we don't need Strike Force, we've got no enemies. So we thought that they were going to get rid of 75 Squadron, but they got rid of 75 and 14 and 2, of course. I thought, there was another Labour Prime Minister in 1941 who said, we won't send our troops into the area without close air support again. But then, like the Phoenix, in 2015 they were reformed as 14 Squadron, flying the Beechcraft T6 Texan training aircraft, which we're flying or is being flown now. So, at the end, what was achieved? Well, certainly I think New Zealand did very well and punched above her weight. It was also a very good training for the commanders. It stopped the communist incursion at that stage. Is the world a better place? Nah. Could we do it again? I don't think there's any argument about that one. However, Jeff Wallingford, who there's a picture of him when he was in the confrontation, said, well, we felt we had a very worthwhile role, and we certainly enjoyed what we were doing. So, yes, it was a good, worthwhile response from New Zealand's side. And that's about it. Just as a matter of interest, I've also got a Royal Malay Regiment badge here. So the Royal Malays were used quite a lot, obviously with Federation and Independence. They didn't exist, but I'll just put that there too.
Questions? I mean, we've got a number of Malay veterans here. I'm sure they won't want to challenge Peter, but Tom and a few others who've experienced Southeast Asia. Are there any questions of Peter? Yeah.
What's the range and endurance time of the Minotaur?
I can't remember. Tom, do you know?
Sorry, I didn't hear.
What's the range of flying time of the Venom?
The range?
Yeah.
Duration.
Couldn't possibly remember.
All I know is...
When did you run out of fuel?
No, I never did.
All I know is that they were flying on a tight schedule. Sorry, I don't know.
Any other questions? Any reminiscences?
So did you have any contact with the local population when you were there?
Did who have contact?
The flyers in top.
Oh yeah. And as I said earlier, unfortunately the airmen had certain types of contact with the local population, but that was part of the problem with the families. The Memsahib would find it very hard to tell the store owner that this is what I want or this is what's wrong with the car. But yes, there were certainly places that they could go to. Raffles, of course.
I mean, when you think about the number of individuals that Peter's mentioned, I mean, Stewie McIntyre was Chief of Defence when he retired, and I remember he flew a couple of missions down to the Antarctic for us. But those who served in Southeast Asia, I mean, Mike Palmer was our commander, S4C commander, in the early 80s. And in fact, it was 1982 that we actually closed Tenga down.
Yeah.
And then, Hugh, we moved over to Hialeah when you were there.
Yes.
So, you know, all of that was going on at the time. Any other comments?
I'll just also say there, Hugh was with 41 Squadron, and they just had a reunion last week. So I want to talk to you about that and about freighters. And this is really a very good book. This is by Chris Pugsley on confrontation, New Zealand's response.
And of course, last year Dave Hayward did a very good presentation on confrontation. It was last year. Sorry, Hugh.
I was going to mention, I did see 5 Squadron Sutherland appear on the Board of Combat for the RNZ of input to Malaya at the time. We got the Sutherland in 1953, and I don't know how many there were, but they went up to Malaya and they actually dropping bombs by hand out through the beam hatch. So they had close.
Sorry, that's right about 5 Squadron. Don't know why I didn't pick that up.
Any others? So, look, without further ado, can I once again thank you all for turning up today, and thanks very much, Peter, for the presentation.